This is Generation Swap. While the world talks about a generation gap,
we talk about generational connection. Our guests, we call them swap mates, discuss goals, passions, and values, helping each other figure out life.
Keep listening for more.
Welcome to Generation Swap. We're your hosts, Cindy Camp
and Dana Hebriard.
And today we're in our studio talking with Gary Eberle and with Aiden Raphael. We're delighted to have you both here and trust that you'll tell us a little bit about yourselves as we talk. The first thing that we'd like to ask, you know, you've been paired as part of our Generation Swap project here at Aquinas College, but you've only known each other for a few months. And we'd love to know something important that you've learned about each other during this semester.
Yeah, so we've struggled to meet with a whole lot of frequency, just crazy schedules and all that. But, you know, over getting to know each other, certainly one of the important things is that Mr. Eberle was, you know, a professor here, obviously very well respected in the Hall of Fame here now. So that's a big thing. But also cool to find out how involved he still is at Aquinas, despite having retired and being involved in the community as a whole. Things like the musical that you just put on and all that. I think that was a really cool thing to sit and hear about over the last couple of months. So.
And Aiden, tell us a little bit about you, like your age, and I see you have a golf sweatshirt on. So,
I'm 22. I'm a political science student here at Aquinas, graduating in May, going to University of Michigan Law School. I play on the golf team here. That's kind of the rundown.
That's you.
Yep.
Okay.
Gary, what about you and something you've learned about Aiden?
Well, he's already touched on the things that... his golf team commitment and his political science. We have a lot of interests in those areas, as well as his journey into law school and the decision-making process. We talked a little bit about what to expect when you jump from the undergraduate to the graduate level, and I think he's ready. He doesn't think he's ready, and that's a good thing because that'll make him work harder. So we've just had very laid-back conversations at our lunches, and he encouraged me to go to the Schnitzelbank Deli, where I've not been in a few years, so I appreciated that, and I hope we get at least one more meeting before he graduates.
And Gary, your age, and Aiden talked a little bit about some of the things that you're doing, but maybe you want to highlight something?
Well, I'll be 72 in a few weeks. I retired from Aquinas 6 years ago. I was a professor of English and chair of the English department. I've written several books of various kinds over the years and have stayed in touch with and involved with Aquinas since retirement. Not because I don't have any place better to go, but it is a very good place to go and to stay engaged with, especially after my 35 years here.
So this semester, the students have been involved in a class Dr. Ian Borton is teaching. It's an honors course about heroes. And I wanted to know from each of your perspectives, in what ways intergenerational relationships like the one you've been building over these past months overlap with the idea of having a hero or a role model as a life guide?
Yeah, so one of the, in the book that we read for the class, one of the elements of a hero story that Joseph Campbell talks about is the role of a mentor or, you know, an Obi-Wan type figure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where the idea of this whole thing came out of. In my mind, you know, I don't think anybody is great or even really good at anything that they do solely by themselves and that they learn solely by themselves. Certainly it helps to have mentorship, so... That's, I think, the big intergenerational aid, I guess, from a relationship like this is somebody who's been there before, especially somebody who's done things like go to graduate school and, you know, been pretty successful in what he's done. To have that sort of mentorship, even if it's not exactly equivalent to what I want to do, is certainly very helpful for me to have that insight into the future.
I think the hero business has fascinated me my whole life. And then when I read the same book that Ian Borton and the class is reading, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, it literally lifted the top of my head off and let sunshine in many ways. And then about 12 years after I left undergrad work, I got to meet Campbell here in Grand Rapids when he came to Fountain Street Church and ran a number of workshops down there. And so over the course of 2 or 3 years, I got to sit with him in small groups and learn about the hero and pick up his energy and his enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And in the process, learned an important lesson, which was that he was, to me, a hero intellectually and had been for a long time. But he also was a flawed and fallible human being. And sorting out that business of what was heroic about him, to me, and the real man, and not being disillusioned by what I discovered, was, I won't say struggle, I won't go that far, but it was a fascinating insight for me.
Yeah, and that is a good segue into another question that we like to ask as we're talking about this topic of heroes or role models. Are there limitations to this idea? Because in our culture, we really talk a lot about heroes, and they have a very important role to play, but maybe sometimes we oversell the idea, or we absolve people of kind of doing for themselves what they're capable of doing. Interesting that you mentioned Joseph Campbell, you know, having frailties, and as we all do. So, Gary, I'd love to have you respond to that first.
I remember when Major League Baseball player Darryl Strawberry had a lot of drug problems. He had all kinds of issues, but he, on the field, he was just terrific. And the media kind of jumped on him, you know, for all of us. And he said, "I didn't sign up to be nobody's role model." And he was right. You know, we project the hero onto people. And then when they're not heroic at every moment, then we are disappointed. So I think that's one danger. The other one, as you say, was to wait for the savior instead of finding the heroic within yourself. And so project onto this heroic person everything we want and need to do for ourselves.
I think that's really powerful. I mean, mm-hmm. that is something that learning that in hindsight, right, as we age. But it would be interesting, in your class, did you have conversations about that? And how did it manifest your, you know, identity of what heroism is?
Yeah, so I'm in this class in a little different way. I'm taking it as an independent study because I have a class, another class that I need to graduate at the same time, of the day. But as far as generally just the ideal of heroism and how we, you know, how, like you said, how we approach it and some critiques of that, basically my task for the semester, as I'm taking this as an independent study, was just go write a big paper. And so the topic of that paper has been, as I approach this from a political science major perspective, how started as how Campbell's heroic rhetoric gets used in politics and has morphed its way. I chose to use Donald Trump as a case study, a very dramatic, very zealous following, that kind of thing. So I think that's kind of one of the big criticisms that I have, especially in politics, is that it benefits a politician to portray themselves as a hero, whether they are or not. And if they're good enough at that and they use that rhetoric well enough, as I think Trump has, you get kind of a following that doesn't really question a lot and puts various figures, and Trump's not the only one certainly, but the one that I'm studying this semester, up on a pedestal, no matter what they're doing, whether it's good or bad. And again, that's kind of a critique of heroism, is once you make somebody a hero, then like, there isn't really a critique of them and they can kind of just do whatever they want with that support.
If they begin to believe their own BS... then we're all in trouble.
Yep.
And I think that's where many people get themselves into a position of leadership that becomes a position from which they abuse people. I think especially for men, the temptation of heroic figures is to take advantage of women. Historically, it's been that. And will present themselves as these flawless savior types. And then impressionable young people will fall for them.
So thinking about transitioning to conversations about failures, I think to your point, when we recognize that we are fallible And we lose that sort of perspective of that heroic identity. And we all have those. And I always say it's about falling forward, right? Learning something from that. And we can celebrate our successes, but I think we also should celebrate the things we try, right? So can you tell us a story maybe, Aiden, of like a failure and what you learned from that?
Yeah, so we talked about my being on the golf team a little bit. I came into college as, you know, I got good grades in high school. I was doing all right, but kind of came in as focused on athletics. I was a big basketball player, tennis, golf in high school, and came here as a golfer, obviously, and kind of thought that's what I was coming to college for at first. I got here and I realized I wasn't that good. I'm still on the team, but, you know, have not had a lot of success in that arena. I've just kind of hovered around, you know, barely being in the lineup, if being in the lineup at all. I joke that I'm there to get guys in the weight room and boost the team GPA. But
yeah,
so that failure of, you know, not being as good at golf as I thought I was, kind of led me to focus more on school and kind of, you know, really embrace that, you know, this is what I'm here for. And again, I got into Michigan Law School, so I think it worked out pretty well. I don't think that would have happened had I come here and, you know, run the WAC conference. I wouldn't have spent the time on school that I have and wouldn't have been successful in that arena or as successful.
Well, from an early age, I found myself drawn to the arts, music and writing especially. And then somewhere in college, I decided I wanted to be a writer and to write. And in both of those areas, you face a lot of rejection. I mean, years. I mean, and horrible experiences of flopping on stage and, you know, the audience just not reacting at all, which is worse than booing in some ways. And it took me, if anyone had told me in my 20s how long it would take for me to get more than one book published, I probably would have quit. And now, looking from the perspective of 72 years old, I think, wow, I kept coming back. You know, the first several years of rejection as a writer, you feel it's worthless and your ego gets all caught up in it. And you know, it's not coincidental that so many writers end up depressed or suicidal. It's a brutal profession on the ego. And by the time I was 45, I had had 3 books published. And the novel that I published received a nice review in the New York Times, and I was New York Times book review, and I was flying. Until I talked with my publisher and I said, "You're going to do another printing?" And he said, "Nah." He said, "Times Review doesn't really mean that much." I said, "Well, it meant a lot to me."
Wow.
And he was right about sales. You know, you anyway, without getting into that long story, how we come back from failure and rejection, I think, is more important than what we achieve.
And that's a profound observation and something we all should be, considering, especially those who are still in that earlier stage of life with a long
thinking of that old Zen expression, although the Zen monk says, you fall 6 times and you get up 7 times. That's success.
And I think you're really wise, Aiden, to think about how your golf career has influenced your academic then journey, right? And things always happen for a reason. And so getting to Michigan, which is a huge accomplishment, law school, and then what you do there, you'll have had these experiences, but you'll still have that golf skill that will probably come in handy in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully, hopefully there's some deals that get made out on the golf course and such. So
still today, yeah, right. I know that's true from my son and his career.
So Gary, for you, social science research has shown that the first half of life, many of us live according to maybe other people and other people's reactions. And then as we get older, that second half of life, we get better at listening to our own inner voice and what might be guiding us. Can you talk about ways that you've been able to be more true to yourself in that second half of life?
Well, you know what? As I looked at that question, which you gave me ahead of time, I realized I lived my life backwards in some ways. That when I was young, I was rebellious. I not wild or not law-breaking, but just I'm going to do my thing, you know. And for me, that was music. It involved sneaking into bars for open mic nights and singing for all the beer I could drink, which was a lot, even though I was underage. You know, and stuff like that. What, just breaking all the expected rules. Like, I didn't major in anything as an undergraduate. It was the late 60s, and you could, at the university I went to, design your own major. So I went to my advisor, whom I trusted and was a hero to me, and I said, who are the best teachers on campus? And I don't care what they're teaching. And that's my undergraduate degree. And so, no, I didn't. And then at one point, when I was supposed to be writing a dissertation, I got totally disgusted with the academic world and said, screw it, I'm not going to ever end up in education. 35 years later, here I am.
Love that.
But and I walked away from that and spent 3 years freelance writing and had a blast, and then found my way back into education here at Aquinas in a way that I could do it my way. So when I was in grad school, we were taught to teach by a method. And I just bridled against that, and I couldn't do it. Yeah. Then as I got older and had to assume duties of being a father and a husband and a homeowner and a respectable professor, though I don't think I was that respectable, I was still fun, and all of that. And so my outer life got a little more conventional, but my inner life always remained unconventional and still is.
I think you knew your core all along. Like, you stayed true to yourself.
Yeah, and the world didn't like that all the time, but I did, you know.
You probably slept better as a result.
Well,
there's a lot to be said for a good night of sleep and a soft pillow.
When I did meet Campbell, and I had read many of his books, but he used to quote a line from Nietzsche about a wheel rolling out of its own center. And I think that's just the way I was born. I had to go out of my own center.
So, Aidan, when you think about life after college, what else would be helpful to learn from mentors or role models in your own life?
Yeah, so I think certainly as I get into my career, Mr. Everly's had a pretty good work-life balance. You know, you've done a lot of stuff. Not only has your work really interested you, but you've done a lot of stuff outside of that. Keep you sane, enjoy it, you know, whatever. But having that work-life balance, I think, especially going into a career in law, like, that's kind of a hard thing to have. But, you know, having that mentorship of how to juggle all those things going forward, I think, and it won't really mean anything to me until I'm out in that career. You know, I don't have any way to fathom what that looks like. But moving forward, yeah, I think that's definitely something that I could learn and something that you've done really well.
Well, especially law. It's such. My daughter-in-law is in her, I think, sixth or seventh year of practice right now. And the first 3 years, once you're out of law school, are brutal. They're absolutely brutal. And you have to find that space that's yours and not the company's, you know?
I lived with a couple of attorneys in a group house in Washington, D.C. in my 20s. Mm. And gosh, sometimes they were home at 9, 11, 2 in the morning, night after night, depending on the work they were doing. So it's an intense line of work. I know you're interested in environmental law, right? Yeah. Maybe you want to say just a little bit about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, so coming to Aquinas, I started off taking Dr. Durham's World in Crisis class, and I'd always, you know, I've been a pretty outdoorsy person. You were saying on my laptop earlier, you know, I got all the outdoor stickers and stuff. So I came as an outdoorsy person, and in that World in Crisis class, Dr. Durham has kind of a notorious assignment, you know, a big paper on some international issue. Wrote that on the Paris Accord, which is the International Agreement on Climate Change right now. And that kind of propelled me into that world of environmental law and environmental politics. And I just loved it and started researching more and more on it as I went through undergrad. That's kind of what I've tailored my undergrad towards, is more of an environmental political science degree. Culminating in a research project over last summer that I got to work on with Dr. Durham. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, that's kind of where that came from. And you know, as I go through law school, hope to work on, you know, clinics and journals that pertain to the environment. And then also when I get out, hopefully work for the EPA, and eventually get into some sort of, policy lobbying, in favor of, you know, clean energy or something like that. So definitely some work that I hope to, you know, contribute to the betterment of the world in.
Well, it sounds like an exciting future. Mm-hmm. and work that will be so important to, not only for you, but for many others who we all are aware of the needs of our environment and our climate.
And that's another thing that will work to your advantage, Aidan, is that you've got a foot in the future when you invest your energy in this environmental movements and the legal ends of it. Because it's one thing to carry a sign somewhere, but if you're in the field working day to day, you're really making a difference.
So we just want to thank you all for being a part of the conversation today. This has been so wonderful. I really appreciate you, Aidan and Gary, for sharing, and hope that you continue your relationship. And we'd love to hear how you're doing in law school. Go blue. You have to say go blue back.
Yeah,
go blue. That's the rule. That's the rule.
Hey, I've always been a Sparty fan, so I feel like a bit of a traitor now.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You'll be great. Ann Arbor is actually a really cool place to live. My son is a freshman there, so he is enjoying it immensely as well. So we want to thank you, listeners, and thank you, Aidan and Gary, for this conversation, and hope you all, you know, join us again.
Thank you guys for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Generation Swap is a production of the Aquinas College Advantage Center. You can find our show wherever you get your podcasts or at generationswap.com. Our career and connections expert is Dr. Dana Hebriard. Our producer is John Griffin, and our social media coordinator is Alexandra Stephenson. I'm Cindy Camp, Generation Swap creator. Thank you for spending time with us today. We're looking forward to swapping stories with you again soon.